There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel. I'm your host on today's program. Some highlights from 2007 and looking forward to what we might be looking at in 2008. We'll hear from Vince Cerf, internet evangelist at Google, and Maria Juliana Bick from Paper Tiger Television. You do want to stay tuned. Well, as we wrapped up the year, we had a big FCC meeting on December 18th, which we did review on the last Media Geek program on with John Anderson of DIYmedia.net. And one decision that we didn't quite get a chance to cover that the FCC made that same December 18th night was to place some limits on cable television. Now, you see, there's a law, which was passed many years ago, which gave the FCC to begin having greater enforcement powers, greater regulatory powers over cable television, including being able to mandate a certain content requirements when the cable television industry reaches the ability to get 70% to reach 70% of the households in the country, and 70% of those households are subscribers. Last month, back in November, Chairman Kevin Martin tried to convince his fellow commissioners that that moment had been reached, and he had some research to show it. His fellow Republicans weren't so convinced, challenged the veracity of his research, and wanted more data. So they're asking the cable industry to provide direct data on how many subscribers they have and how many households might possibly get their service. In the meantime, Kevin Martin joined up with the FCC's two Democrats to say, we're now capping cable companies at 30%. 30% of the households is the maximum a given company can now reach. Nobody is yet there, although the largest company in the country, Comcast, is within spitting distance. And so Comcast is very unhappy about this particular decision, which means that the company cannot expand much more at all because it reaches just under 30% of the nation's subscribers. Of course, in the background, Comcast has been in the news because of their efforts to block and spoof peer-to-peer traffic over the BitTorrent protocol, blocking both legal and illicit downloads. BitTorrent is actually used by a lot of independent software makers or musicians, and are people looking to move large quantities of data, which is often required for software or for music, high-quality music or video. And if you're a Comcast customer, you're finding that you might not be getting any of that traffic. You might not be able to download any of that stuff over the BitTorrent protocol. It's caused people to take up the issue again of network neutrality as the big carriers, whether it's Verizon Cell Service, whether it's AT&T, whether it's T-Mobile, blocking Twitter traffic, a particular website, over its cellular network, or Comcast blocking a particular type of traffic, BitTorrent peer-to-peer traffic. People are realizing that the heavy control over the internet by these different companies, a very few number of companies at that, indeed may be problematic. So that's why I want to go back to the April 27th edition of Media Geek, when I played a talk by Vinton Cerf. He's the internet evangelist at Google, and he is one of the founders of the internet. One of the research scientists who worked on and designed the internet protocol, which became the foundation of the internet more than 40 years ago. It's a talk he gave on April 10th at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign here in the hometown of Media Geek. And he talks a little bit about where the internet is, a little bit of where it's going and how it works and why we need to protect it.
Well, let's jump in. I want to start out by giving you just a quick glimpse of where the internet is today. You can see that if we were here 10 years ago, I would be touting the 22 million servers that were on the internet, not counting laptops and desktops that might be episodically connected, and 50 million users. 10 years later, there are, well, in fact, 9 years later, there were almost 400 million hosts. I don't actually have the data for January 2007 yet, so I'm going to have to dig that up. My guess is there are probably about 500 million or more servers on the network, not counting desktops, laptops, personal digital assistants, and other internet-enabled devices, and over a billion users. Now, at the same time that the internet's been growing during that 10-year period, something else has been happening in the telecom world, and that is the introduction of about 2.5 billion mobile devices. These are not just telephones, they're programmable devices, and many of them are internet-enabled already. The implication of that is that for many people in the world, their first introduction to internet may very well be through a mobile rather than through a laptop or a desktop. So that's having a significant impact on the direction in which internet applications are heading because they have to accommodate some of the constraints of those devices. I thought you might find it amusing to go back to those days of yesteryear before the internet when the first large-scale packet switch network was built, sponsored by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. The first four nodes were at UCLA, SRI International in the Menlo Park Bay Area in San Francisco area, UC Santa Barbara, and University of Utah. Of course, later on, Champaign-Urbana campus and the National Center for Supercomputer Applications became very, very important parts of that network. I was a graduate student at UCLA in 1969, responsible for programming the Sigma 7, the one at the lower bottom here, which was the first of the computers to be connected to the ARPANET. Its job was to actually measure the traffic of the network, to inject fake traffic, to gather statistics, to compare with the queuing models that Professor Leonard Kleinrock had developed when he was a graduate student at MIT, and then brought that research with him to UCLA. So the Sigma 7 is in a museum now. Some people have suggested I should be there too, but I hope that I'm still able to contribute a little bit to the continued evolution of this system. Well, if we fast forward 30 years in time, the internet looks like that in 1999. About all you can tell from this is that it got bigger, it got more connected, and it got more colorful. In fact, there are something like 250,000 networks that are all interconnected, if you count everything, including, you know, the local networks that you have at home or in school or in the office, possibly even more networks than that. So it's become a very, very large-scale infrastructure. One of the other interesting things to look at is where the users are. Now, if we were having this discussion 10 years ago, the bulk of the users would have been in North America. Today, what you find is that the largest single grouping of users is in Asia. It shouldn't be too surprising because that includes China and India and Japan and Indonesia and so on. 56% of the world's population falls into the Asian category. So not only are they the largest single group today, but they will continue to be and become absolutely the largest element on the internet. That has all kinds of implications for content, for example, languages that are used, perhaps styles of interaction, and kinds of interests that people have. So that's going to be a very strong influence on the way in which the internet evolves. Europe is the next largest grouping. Of course, Europe keeps redefining itself by adding more countries. They just added a few more, including Bulgaria, which means that Cyrillic is now an official European language. Or sort of like a European alphabet. That has, again, an impact on the way in which the internet evolves because of the need for representation of so many new languages and new alphabets and new symbol sets. Probably the most difficult part of the net to help evolve is Africa, where there are at least 1 billion people on the continent, but at the time these data were produced in early January, only about 33 million users, and most of them would be found in North Africa, in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Morocco, or in South Africa. Although it's true that every country in Africa does have some internet access. Frequently it's in the capital city, often it might be in the major university in the capital city, with the rest of the continental infrastructure still very light, in many cases produced by satellite as opposed to fiber linkages. So there's still a lot of work to be done in that part of the world. And in spite of the big numbers, the billion users seems like a big number until you realize that's only 1/6 of the world's population. So the internet evangelist at Google feels like he has a long way to go to get another 5.5 billion people up on the net. My estimate is, though, that there will be on the order of 3 billion people on the net by the end of 2010. A significant fraction of them will be on by way of internet-enabled mobiles. And we could argue over how well connected that is, but there will be at least some capability through those devices to interact with network-based resources. Well, let's talk a little bit about the technology that's shaping the network, and has shaped it, and will be shaping it. When Bob Kahn and I were first doing this design, it was 1973. We'd had 4 years of experience with the ARPANET and with packet switching. We were fully convinced that packet switching was, in fact, a highly successful technology for computer communication, that it was better suited than the traditional circuit switching of the telephone system. When Bob Kahn came to visit me at Stanford University, where I had a lab that was starting to do research on networking, he pointed out that that the military was interested in having computers in use in command and control. And for that to be realistic, these machines had to be, computers had to be available in mechanized infantry, had to be available in ships at sea, as well as fixed locations. So that meant implicitly that we needed mobile radio capability and we needed satellite capability for ship-to-ship and ship-to-shore. We had the wireline demonstration of the ARPANET to show that it was feasible in those contexts. But his problem when he showed up at Stanford was to get networks that were all packet switched but using these different media to interwork in a uniform way that was essentially transparent to the computers that were at the edges. At the time, we realized that we didn't know what new transmission and switching technologies would be invented after we finished the design of internet. So we coined a general principle, which was that the internet packets of the internet protocol layer should run on virtually any transmission and switching system that would deliver a bag of bits from point A to point B with some probability greater than zero. That's all we asked of the underlying transmission system. Everything else that delivered things in sequence and recovered from loss and things of that sort would happen at higher layers of protocol at the end of the net. Now, in order to emphasize this idea of getting everything to work on top of any communication system, I had a t-shirt made that said IP on everything. And that's basically what I've been doing for the last 35 years, is trying to make sure the internet protocol actually works on virtually any transmission system. Now that we've got to the point where it's a very widespread protocol, I think I need a new t-shirt, because people are assuming that it's there and they're building new layers of protocol on top. So I think my new t-shirt should say IP under everything. Now, one of the things that I hadn't fully appreciated is that this internet layer of protocol had another feature to it that has profoundly shaped the evolution of the net. And that feature is that the packets don't know what they're carrying. So they literally don't, they know they're carrying a bag of bits, but they don't know how to interpret them. So the internet layer doesn't know what the applications are. It doesn't know if it's carrying a piece of a web page or part of email or possibly a digitized audio or video signal. All it knows is moving bits from A to B. The result is that the net is almost exclusively an end-to-end construct. The underlying network component delivers chunks of data, packets, but everything else does the actual application at the edge. So this end-to-end principle has been used to evolve new applications on the net without having to ask permission of or to make changes to the underlying network infrastructure, except possibly for increased capacity in order to carry larger amounts of data or to deliver lower latency. But the networks themselves that make up the internet are not sensitive to the applications that they're running. This has led to a concept called network neutrality, which says that the net is essentially insensitive to the applications, and that the operators of the network should be equally insensitive to whose data is being moved around. This is not an argument that says you shouldn't be able to prioritize a packet. That's not the issue. The issue is that you don't want to change the way in which you offer service by discriminating between one supplier of an application and another. Everyone should have equal access to the network, and if it's necessary that some of the packets have priority because they're trying to do a low latency application, then anyone who needs that should be able to get it. If we don't do that, we end up with a real problem, because the people who are providing broadband internet services potentially could decide that they would discriminate against competitors who are offering competing higher level services that are also riding over the same underlying infrastructure, and I think that would be a constraint on user choice, because that would inhibit users from getting applications from virtually anywhere in the internet if it were in fact limited to or favored only those services coming from the underlying broadband service provider.
And that's Vinton Cerf, internet evangelist for Google and one of the founders of the Modern Internet Protocol, which, as you understand, is underneath the entire internet. That talk was on April 10th at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign and was part of the Beckman Lecture Series. That aired originally this year on Media Geek on the April 27th show. And you can find all the Media Geek archives at radio.mediageek.net. You can also find the blog at mediageek.net. And if you have any comments, send it to me, paul@mediageek.net. And I am doing kind of a, not an entire highlight show. There's 52 weeks of shows, but just pulling out a couple of highlights from this past year, 2007, on Media Geek, which I think are deserve a second listen and have continuing relevance. So I wanted to listen to Vint Cerf again, because we are tackling network neutrality and tackling the nation's largest cable and therefore one of the largest internet providers, blocking traffic, interfering, in fact, with traffic, spoofing that they are your computer by interfering with the BitTorrent protocol if you want to try and download things over a peer-to-peer network. Also kind of very big, again, is still video on the internet. Gets bigger and bigger. User-generated videos, it's known in the online industry, like YouTube, and other sites are trying to come in and steal a little bit of YouTube's thunder. Continue to be very popular. We've seen a real, increase in people producing their own video, and producing their own video not just for family memories, but for wider public consumption. Something I think is just a really great turn of events, because it places a lot more power in the hands of people to tell their own stories, which is really part of the reason why Media Geek is here. But it's not necessarily a new thing. It just used to be a little bit more difficult before there was the internet. But there was public access television. And one of the big players in public access television celebrated its 25th anniversary this year, Paper Tiger Television. Going back to New York City, providing really cutting-edge productions that were both very DIY in nature, and so thus not as slick or as polished as what you would see on network television or in big Hollywood productions, but very, very cutting-edge from the standpoint of being critical about the dominant mainstream media and dominant political structures, bring on well-known academics and activists and just regular people and encouraging them to find their voice through television, through video, and then giving them the opportunity to see that work distributed, both on public access television there in New York City and via tape networks and at some point satellite networks across the country to other public access television channels or via VHS or DVD. As part of their 25th anniversary celebration, Paper Tiger released a 45-minute documentary called Paper Tiger Reads, Paper Tiger Television. One of the producers is Maria Juliana Bick, and she spoke with me on the October 19th edition of Media Geek.
Paper Tiger Television is a volunteer video collective, and we started 25 years ago as a group of people who were really interested in using public access television to look at the media industry. And so we started off as a regular television show, usually a live broadcast, and we would bring in people who had interesting things to say about different media. And so a regular show would happen every week or every other week, and over, you know, the first few years, it became really well known in the both academic and alternative media circles. And so we were creating a show that a lot of people really liked. And after a few years, a lot of people were calling in and wanting to have our tapes. So we started sending tapes out across the country and really started a whole kind of little phenomenon of do-it-yourself media that really had a fun, funky edge to it, but also looked at the media in a critical way. And so that was 25 years ago, and over the years, you know, different people have joined the collective and have been interested in investigating different aspects of the media, and also have become more involved in social justice media. And so there's been a lot of really interesting programs and documentaries, short documentaries that Paper Tiger has made.
So you've expanded beyond just having the one program and are helping people learn how to make their own video and documentary work then.
Yeah, we do that in a lot of different ways. People join the collective for lots of different reasons. A lot of people are interested in learning production, and a lot of people who join the collective are also interested in kind of advocacy work or being more involved in a community organization and a collective environment. So we get all kinds of people, and as a collective, we're non-hierarchical, and we make decisions on a consensus basis. And so, you know, in that kind of environment, things are going to change a lot based on who's there and who has interesting projects that they want to work on that other people want to work on as well. So, yeah, in the last few years, we've done a lot more kind of documentary style, more edited and produced than the early shows, which were really kind of live and spontaneous. And so it's just, you know, it depends on who's there and what the interests are and what's happening out in the world that the people in the collective feel is an interesting thing to investigate.
Now, would you say the change in what Paper Tiger has produced also sort of mirrors a bit of the technological changes since, you know, certainly in the 1980s, we didn't have digital nonlinear editing equipment. It was a little, took a little bit more esoteric skill and maybe access to technology to produce television than it does now in a certain way.
Yes, definitely. I think the when Paper Tiger first started, the only thing that was really out there in terms of national media was the three major networks. And so what Paper Tiger did at that time was try and create, you know, a complete alternative to that environment. So what we did was spontaneous and non-scripted and had gave people a lot of time to talk. There was, it wasn't the soundbite culture at all. It was kind of giving someone half an hour to investigate one issue in depth, and also really kind of interesting ways of using the media. We had a very distinct aesthetic that was obviously not part of the corporate mainstream media, and that a lot of our graphics were handmade, and we had a cranky, which was a homemade little crank that would scroll, you know, the credits and information instead of anything computer-generated, and it gave it this real kind of handmade, accessible feel that was designed. It was both kind of out of necessity, but it was also a statement that, you know, making media doesn't have to be, an elusive and, you know, highly produced process. It could be something that is done spontaneous and is done with a group of people who are really committed. And so in that way, it not only was the content different in that we were looking critically at the media and approaching things in a much more in-depth fashion than the mainstream media usually does, but we were also creating a whole other look for, like, what TV could look like. So, yeah, and then when, you know, handheld equipment became more attainable, you know, in that it wasn't as expensive and a group of people could buy a camera or something, then people started, you know, thinking about hitting the streets and getting out and doing more documentary-style work. And so we did a lot of pieces that documented social actions, you know, the labor strikes in Pittston labor strike, and also the Tompkins Square Park demonstrations when, you know, counteracting the gentrification that was happening in New York, and lots of other kind of social action that often isn't fairly or accurately or represented at all in the mainstream media. Paper Tiger would take the cameras and document the perspectives and the social justice movement on the streets. So that's been a lot of what Paper Tiger has been involved in. And then also just looking critically at new and interesting things that are happening in our media environment. So that's always been a thread that's tied together a lot of the work that Paper Tiger is interested in doing.
And you said in the early days, you know, it started out that you were primarily, you were on in New York City, Paper Tiger was, and then you started to send videotapes out. And yeah. And then Paper Tiger got on to other channels or other public access channels as well?
Yes. Yeah. A lot of people, it was in the, you know, beginning days of public access, so there was, you know, a lot of these, you know, communities had TV stations, but they didn't have a lot of programming, so it was kind of the ideal time for an organization like Paper Tiger to come in and, you know, produce stuff that I think a lot of people across the country felt was really interesting and fun, and also, you know, we would provide it free of charge for people to broadcast on their public access stations. So, yeah, I think through that process, began to connect with a lot of the other organizations across the United States who are interested in media reform and alternative media production. And I think in a lot of ways it was the beginning of the network that kind of culminated in Seattle at the WTO protests and kind of, you know, spurred on this whole alternative media movement. There were groups across the country that were interested in producing Paper Tiger production. So we started off in New York, and then there was a group that sprung up in San Francisco and one in San Diego, and different cities also, you know, produced Paper Tiger, and also internationally, Paper Tiger aesthetic and kind of idealism or philosophy was also very popular. So people from around the world kind of looked at it and tried to emulate it in certain ways, and also we would partner with them on productions when it seemed to be a good idea.
And because Paper Tiger is a collective and decentralized in a way, I guess it was easy for people to join in and for the idea to grow without there having to be some very centralized organization calling the shots.
Exactly. And I think that that's something that I feel is part of the future of Paper Tiger, is that now there are so many, you know, Paper Tiger was an early advocate for do-it-yourself media and everybody being a media maker, and now everybody is a media maker, you know, with their cell phone, you can make videos or, you know, with your camera, and so a lot of people are media makers now, and I think Paper Tiger is, hopefully we're thinking about, you know, getting into a position where we can become a place where people are interested in producing Paper Tiger-type productions, that we can be kind of a hub for that kind of work, and to continue our leadership in the field, but also to nurture, new and interesting approaches to using the media as a tool for creating community and creating better citizens and more active and artistic and, you know, critical looks at our social conditions.
As Maria Juliana Bick from Paper Tiger Television talking about Paper Tiger and its 25th anniversary this year. That interview originally aired on the October 19th edition of Media Geek. If you're interested in seeing Paper Tiger Reads, Paper Tiger Television, it will be playing Tuesday, February 19th at the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive at 7:30 p.m. And Maria will be there in person to talk about both Paper Tiger and that documentary. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, KWMD Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska, WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont, and Free Radio Olympia
Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.